this, Kolinsky said, but a moment later he broke into a grin. Well, now that I've got my cautionary boss moment out of the way, let's see what we've got. Almost as if on cue, Toyota entered the conference room. He was carrying a gray box whose cover featured a colorfully drawn silhouette of the Super Famicom and two controllers. Kind of looks like something a kid with chalk might draw at recess, Nilsson said. Toyota opened the box and dutifully laid its contents on the table, prompting the Sega employees to breathlessly lean in like doctors carefully observing a cutting-edge surgery. The lively picture on the cover was a sharp contrast to the dull, boxy system itself.
Is it just me? Schroeder asked. Or does anyone else think that if this machine could talk, it would ask to be put out of its misery?
As everyone chuckled, Kolinsky picked up one of the two identical controllers. These are real nice, though, he said. They were indeed. Soft, sleek, and popping with colorful buttons in blue, red, yellow, and green.
Look, they have a fourth button, Toyota said, referring to the fact that the Genesis only had three.
Nilsson took the controller from Kolinsky.
Wait, he said, feeling grooves atop the controller.
I think they've hit a couple more buttons up here. They've got them hidden everywhere. Who cares? Kolinsky said. Let's get past the superficial and fire this up. Al, will you do the honors?
Sure thing, Nilsson said, scooping up the system and bringing it over to the television to hook it up. He was Sega's resident AV guy, often joking that if the whole marketing thing didn't work out, he'd always have a job setting up games, movies, and presentations.
We're all set, Nilsson said, detaching the last wire. Just need a game.
Kolinsky handed Nilsson a gray cartridge containing Super Mario World, but just as Nilsson was about to insert it, he paused dramatically.
What's wrong? Kolinsky asked.
Another hidden button?
No,
Nilsson said, holding up the bottom of the cartridge.
Look. There's no way any of the old games will work on this new system.
Maybe they have some kind of converter, Kolinsky suggested.
Very possible, Ryo said. Like we have for Master System games.
Nilsson shrugged and inserted the game.
Maybe. But if I had to guess, I'd say that Nintendo just hurt themselves way more than anything we ever could have done to them. Arrogance, after all.
Nilsson cut himself off and the game's title flashed across the screen. Sega employees silently watched as Nilsson played through the first level. The first thing that struck everyone was that while Sonic was brilliantly fast, Mario was obliviously slow. Sonic was chaotically determined, Mario was peacefully subdued. But most important, Sonic was something new, and Mario was, strangely and amazingly, just more of the same. As if proving this point, a bubbly jingle played as 16-bit Mario's face turned embarrassingly red and he died on screen. Nilsson had been unable to guide the titular character away from the wrath of a slow but determined turtle wearing a football helmet. In the wake of the Red Plumber's death, Kolinsky finally broke the silence.
Hey, Al. Do you have any plans for this upcoming weekend?
No. Not yet, Nilsson said, this time successfully avoiding the charging turtle in the football helmet.
Why? How would you like to go on a date?
Nilsson paused the game.
With?
Kolinsky pointed to the Super Famicom.
Nintendo, of course. Take this thing home, play through more of the game, and make sure there are no surprises. If the controllers have hidden buttons, who's to say that the game doesn't have a few tricks up its sleeve?
What do you say?
Sure thing. I'd be happy to put the moves on Mario, Nilsson said, a smile crinkling across his face. Just make sure this doesn't get back to the princess.
Chapter 14. Segaville. One of Kolinsky's greatest assets at Mattel had been a list of industry contacts, a list so extensive that it rivaled the Yellow Pages. In those days, he didn't just know the top executives at every company along the toy spectrum, but also knew which marketing guys they trusted, which salesmen they didn't, and which gabby receptionists didn't realize their gossip revealed vital pieces of information. Simply put, Kolinsky had a Rolodex that put other men's to shame. He still had that same Rolodex,
But with its majority of contacts being in the toy business, he was now trying to build up a similar resource for video games. To create such a network, Kalinske spent his mornings on the phone speaking with industry players, financial analysts, and friends from his past life who might have insight into trends. Normally, he wasn't looking for much, just some game development news, rumors of a hot property, or even a golf date. Today, however, he was expecting to hear the first wave of feedback on Nintendo's new system. His initial calls went to retailers. They usually had good contacts overseas, and more important, had the most to gain or lose. If Nintendo had put out a great product, they were sure to make another fortune. But if it was lacking, then the retailers would be looking for a plan B, which Sega was more than happy to provide. Because of the time difference, he started with guys on the East Coast. To his surprise, everybody called spoke about the Super Famicom as if it were the second coming. Apparently, the thing had taken Japan by storm, selling out in a matter of hours. This was an unexpected pie in Kalinske's face, though he was glad to hear that many of the retailers were still secretly rooting for Sega.
"Sooner or later, those jerks will get what's coming to them,"
Tasso Koken said in a huffy New Jersey accent. Koken was a buyer for the Wiz, a Northeast electronics chain that had recently gained traction by virtue of a catchy jingle, "Nobody Beats the Wiz," and betting big on sponsorships with all the New York sports franchises.
"Now, I hate to admit that it seems like it'll be later rather than sooner, but trust me, it's gonna happen."
"I appreciate the kind words," Kalinske said.
"Not just words," Koken said. "Actions, my friend."
"I like the sound of that. Were you able to get us more shelf space?"
"No, but I got you better shelf space. End caps, dead center, everything eye level. Cream of the crop."
"Every little bit helps," Kalinske said with a chuckle. "Let me know if you hear anything else about Nintendo."
"Will do. But so far, sounds like the real deal."
Kalinske thanked Koken for the intel and hung up. As he sat at his desk, wondering if he was seeing only what he wanted to see, Nilsson tapped on the door and poked his head into Kalinske's office.
"Have a second?"
"Only if you play through more of the game," Kalinske said, waving him in.
"More?"
"I played through all of the game," Nilsson said with a grim expression on his face.
"And so I come bearing bad news."
"How bad?" Kalinske asked, bracing himself.
"Very bad," Nilsson said, his frown morphing into a grin. "For Nintendo."
"Yeah?" Kalinske said, raising an eyebrow. "Don't get me wrong," Nilsson said.
"It's fun, it's finely tuned, and it's expertly leveled. It's just so well crafted from a gameplay standpoint, which is what Nintendo does so well, and exactly what I would expect from them."
Kalinske smiled.
But, I spent the entire weekend playing it, and at no point did I feel wowed. Yeah, the graphics were a little better, there were some slight gameplay tweaks, which were nice, but nothing revolutionary."
Kalinske clapped his hands together with excitement.
"Yep, I was doing a lot of that myself," Nilsson said.
"The whole time I just kept thinking over and over and over, this is 12-bit Mario. A step in the right direction, but definitely not a leap forward. Nintendo dropped the ball."
"I knew it," Kalinske said. "All morning the retailers have been telling me that they've heard it's the best thing since sliced bread. I admit I was a little surprised at first, but that's gotta be because they haven't seen it firsthand."
Nilsson nodded.
"That sounds about right. In the famous words of our esteemed cliché makers, seeing is believing."
"Yes, it is," Kalinske said. "And you, sir, have seen."
"I have, and I'm 100% confident that we have a winner."
Kalinske thought for a minute, letting the golden words echo in his head. Sega had the better product. It was no longer speculation or fantasy, but a matter of fact. This was everything Kalinske had hoped for, and now Sega had no excuse not to beat Nintendo.
"Okay. We have a winner," he said. "But that wasn't enough. There needed to be something more. Some way to make this distinction obvious and enticing, just like in that Reebok Bungie commercial. I want you to prove it. To me and to the world."
"How, exactly?"
"I don't know yet. And neither do you," Kalinske said. "But I'm confident that at some point you will, and when that happens, heads will roll."
"All right," Nilsson said, turning to leave. "I'll start strategizing."
"Wait," Kalinske said.
Did you bring it back, the Super Famicom?
Yep, it's in my car. You need it?
I think so, Kalinske said. It's time I pay a visit to an old friend. Now armed with complete confidence in his product and a mandate from Japan to make changes as he saw fit, Kalinske arranged for another meeting with Walmart. This time he traveled down to Arkansas with Toyota, hoping that a tag-team effort would change the electronic merchant's mind once and for all.
Wipe that smirk off your face, Mr. Kalinske. It's very unbecoming, the man from Walmart said, shaking his head and rolling his eyes as the two men from Sega entered. I assume this is the esteemed Shinobu Toyota?
Toyota nodded and quietly introduced himself as he and Kalinske took a seat.
You ought to be taking notes and learning from your colleague, the merchant said to Kalinske. Guy walks in, doesn't say much, and most important, no smirk.
It's not a smirk, Kalinske said. It's a smile. That's all. The merchant emitted a guttural sound of skepticism.
I'm dubious, but I invited you back, so I'm willing to play along. What's this about?
I came to say that I've seen the future.
Oh, yeah? Is that right, Nostradamus?
The merchant asked, and then turned to Toyota, who nodded vigorously in support of Kalinske.
And what exactly did you see?
I saw the American release of Nintendo's new system. Sometime just before the Christmas season, Kalinske said, and then donned a look of mock horror. And people are furious. This new Nintendo costs an arm and a leg and doesn't play any of the old games. That would all be well and good, except that the new system isn't even that much better than the old one. It's all a sham. Kalinske swapped out the look of horror on his face with one of dread. And Walmart's watching all of this happen, wishing that there was something that could save their Christmas season. Lo and behold, there is the Sega Genesis, the world's most advanced video game system. The man from Walmart chuckled.
Nice prophecy, Mr. Kalinske, but there's a slight hitch. Nintendo's new system isn't a sham. From what I hear, it's pandemonium in Japan. They sold out in less than 24 hours, more than 250,000 units. This is true,
Toyota confirmed, leaning forward.
But it is all hype.
My non-smirking friend here is correct, Kalinske said. A big opening weekend for a movie isn't proof that it's any good. It just means they had a nice poster.
Fair enough, but couldn't we have had this tete-a-tete over the telephone?
But then I couldn't have shown you this, Kalinske said, reaching into his travel bag and pulling out the Super Famicom. You can see it for yourself. Is there a television somewhere where we can set this up?
Yes, but that's not gonna happen.
What do you mean? Kalinske said, trying not to sound as surprised as he felt.
There's nothing you can possibly show me on there that will change the fact that Nintendo's made us a lot of money, and will continue to do so. Maybe this 16-bit thing won't be as good as it's cracked up to be, and maybe parents will make a stink, but in the end, they're gonna buy it, so it doesn't really matter.
Kalinske and Toyota didn't believe that, but they realized there was nothing they could do or say to change this man's mind. Seeing was believing, but Walmart wasn't even willing to see what was right in front of their face, let alone what was coming down the line. So they finished the meeting on cordial terms and got a cab for the airport. Moments after getting the cab, however, Toyota saw something that caused a jolt from head to toe.
Stop here,
he told the driver, only a few blocks from Walmart headquarters. Kalinske was confused, but Toyota smirked and held up a finger as if to say, I did not smirk before, but trust me, this will be worth the facial muscles. They paid the driver and got out of the cab. With a travel bag over his shoulder, Toyota led Kalinske toward a for-rent sign hanging from the awning of an unoccupied space in a busy strip mall. When they finally reached the storefront, Toyota didn't need to say a word. Kalinske immediately knew what he was supposed to be looking at, and the possibility sent his mind into overdrive. The location was perfect, centrally located, close to Walmart headquarters and right next to a major highway. He stared at the empty store and imagined a barrage of various displays popping up, Sega hardware and software as far as the eye could see. But they wouldn't even be selling these things, no? This would purely be to drum up interest and drive Walmart crazy when potential buyers were unable to get Sega products from their stores. Kalinske and Toyota stared at the empty store, their smiles widening as their mutual vision expanded in scope and size.
"They will come and pray for free," Toyota said, without turning his head.
"Every day of the week," Kalinske added.
"For as long as they would like." As if making room for an imagined swarm of visitors, Kalinske backed up a few steps and glanced up.
"Look," he said, pointing to a restaurant billboard.
Toyota saw it right away, as Kalinske had before.
Sega would cover every inch of the town in ads telling people where they could go to play video games for free. Billboards, bus stops, park benches. Kalinske and Toyota were going to turn Bentonville, Arkansas into Segaville. They had no idea if the plan would work, but it would certainly force Walmart to take off their blinders and at least look at what Sega wanted them to see.
Chapter 15. The Physicist is Displeased.
"Name?"
Nintendo's receptionist asked, looking up at a tall, finely dressed gentleman with short, dark blonde hair.
"Olaf Olafson," the man replied.
As his copper-colored eyes fixed on the receptionist, a smile slid across one side of his face, while a slight scowl draped across the other.
"And I am here to see Mr. Lincoln," Olafson said in his sing-songy style of speech, which bordered on iambic pentameter. "He should, of course, be expecting my visit, though perhaps I have arrived a tad early."
The receptionist confirmed his appointment with Howard Lincoln and asked him to wait in the brightly lit brown and white lobby. Olafson walked past a glass case containing an ornate crystal horse's head and sat down on a brown couch. It had been a long day thus far, and it was nice to get off his feet. He had grown accustomed to spending much of his days in transit, but traveling to Nintendo of America's headquarters in Redmond, Washington, didn't make for the easiest trip. Nevertheless, there was something very endearing about Redmond. Normally, he divided his time between Manhattan, Los Angeles, and the postcard cities of Europe, so it was nice to be somewhere quaint and quiet. Taking a moment to appreciate his surroundings, he leaned back on the couch and reflected on the unusual life trajectory that had led him here. Olaf Olafson had been born and raised in Reykjavik, Iceland, where he developed a keen passion for math, science, poetry, and athletics. When he was 17 years old, he parlayed his exploits as an amateur Icelandic Renaissance man into a scholarship at an American college. Embracing this opportunity to expand his horizons, he left his homeland and emigrated to the United States, where he studied physics at Brandeis University. In 1985, as he neared the end of his undergraduate studies, Olafson saw his future cleanly divide into two distinct paths. He could continue on this track by getting his master's and PhD, and then joust for position in the small but distinguished community of physicists, or he could live an unexpected life filled with many and diverse interests. Though the spirited competition involved in the former option intrigued him, he was leaning toward the latter. His mentor, a physics professor named Stephen Berko, wished to talk him out of abandoning the scientific path, and so set him up to meet a distinguished former student, Michael Mickey Schulhoff, a high-level executive for Sony's American division. In an unexpected twist, the meeting ended with Olafson not only retiring from a career in physics, but accepting a job at Sony. Schulhoff hired the young man from Iceland to introduce a new technology called CD-ROM. Rising to the challenge, Olafson traveled around the world to demonstrate the amazing audio and visual powers of compact discs to tech companies like HP, Apple, and Microsoft. In early 1991, Olafson was promoted from introducing hardware to selling software. More specifically, he was named president of a new division called Sony Electronic Publishing, which would be responsible for the production of any digital content for computers, multimedia players, or video game systems. This included anything from a CD containing the complete works of William Shakespeare to an interactive game based around an upcoming blockbuster film. The primary source of this content would come from a pair of multi-billion dollar entities that Sony had recently acquired, a prestigious film studio, Columbia TriStar Pictures, and a premier record label, CBS Records. As a result, Olufsen's initial job was to familiarize himself with the various branches of Sony's newest assets and figure out how, if at all, they might fit under the new umbrella of electronic publishing. Whether on the set of a new movie or in the recording studio with a popular artist, Olufsen thoroughly enjoyed learning all aspects of the entertainment industry. Except when it came to video games. Personally, he knew very little about video games. They had not been a part of the social scene back in Iceland, and by the time he got to America, he was too old to get sucked into Nintendo mania. So to understand the industry, he relied on information from ImageSoft, Sony's game publishing imprint, based in Santa Monica. ImageSoft was a third-party licensee of Nintendo, and had released two games for the NES, Solstice and Super Dodgeball. Both had been well-regarded by critics and well-received by consumers, but neither was particularly profitable. This led Olufsen to believe that for all of the talk of video games becoming big business, there wasn't really much money to be made. To test his hypothesis, he met with the ImageSoft team. It turned out he was wrong. There was actually a lot of money to be made in video games. It's just that Nintendo was making most of it. And whatever money they weren't making themselves was essentially being allocated to companies they deemed worthy of eating the remaining slices of the pie. Olufsen realized that the secret to Nintendo's power lay in the cunning licensing process they had created, which required would-be business partners to jump through a complicated series of hoops. Getting into business with Nintendo involved signing their take-it-or-leave-it licensing agreement, which would grant a publisher, like Sony's ImageSoft, the right to produce up to 5 different games per year. In exchange for this privilege, the publisher would have to purchase the game chips directly from Nintendo, give them the exclusive rights to their titles, pay a substantial royalty on units sold, and agree to a variety of other strict conditions. Olufsen didn't find this agreement to be particularly sporting. Nintendo wanted to exert their leverage. They wanted to gouge developers, producers, and publishers. They wanted to be paid everything in advance before a single game was ever sold. Fine. Nintendo had earned the right to call the shots. But it was the next few steps in the process that Olufsen found to be particularly startling. After signing the licensing agreement, a publisher would then invest a great deal of time, money, and energy in producing one of their 5 titles. When they were finished developing a game, they would submit a completed version to Nintendo's headquarters in Redmond, Washington. At some point in the future, it could take days, weeks, or months, the publisher would find out if their game had been approved. But as they eventually realized, games were never approved the first time. So Nintendo would fax over a list of changes, and the publisher would redevelop the game to make the necessary alterations. The publisher would once again send the game to Nintendo, who would either approve the revised submission, or, more typically, send another fax requesting additional changes. This process was repeated until a game was deemed to be up to Nintendo standards. Following the approval, it was finally time for the game to be produced. Naturally, having invested a lot of resources, the publisher would want to order a large quantity of games to increase their profit potential. But because the licensing agreement contractually ensured that Nintendo would be the manufacturer, they would get to determine how many copies would be made. A good rule of thumb was that a publisher would receive about 25% of their desired order, though that total fluctuated based entirely on Nintendo's evaluation. Lastly, the publisher would then wait for the game cartridges to be manufactured and delivered. This would generally take a couple of months, a month for production, another for shipping overseas. But, like every other step of the process, there were no guarantees. If dastardly winds knocked a cargo ship off course, delivery could be delayed a week. But if a global chip shortage struck, as Nintendo insisted was the case in 1988, then everything could be delayed indefinitely. Olufsen was appalled by the absurd dynamics of all this. His company was taking all of the risk, yet Nintendo possessed total control every step of the way and received a large share of the rewards. His dismay turned to disgust upon learning that one of ImageSoft's games, Super Sushi Pinball, had been flat-out rejected and would never be released. He had no idea if this game was any good, nor did he care. His company had spent nearly $1 million to create this game, and also spent even more to develop a marketing campaign around the whimsical tagline, "Finally, a game that tastes as good as it plays." Given this hefty investment, its success or failure should be determined by consumers, not by Nintendo. That was not right, not by a long shot. So he had made the decision to visit Nintendo's headquarters and try his best to balance the equation. As Olufsen looked around the lobby, he made sure to extract any emotion from his demeanor. He did not come here to rant, rave, or rage. He was here, quite simply, as a businessman, who believed it was in Sony and Nintendo's best interest that a special arrangement be made. After all, the two companies had a rich history together. Sony was the manufacturer of the audio chip for the Super Famicom, and in the coming years that relationship would become even tighter, as a result of their joint venture to launch a CD-based game system together. The two companies needed each other, and that should be evident in all facets of their relationships. "Great to finally meet you," said Howard Lincoln, a tall, serious-looking man with soothing eyes and a long, moon-shaped face. He was Nintendo's senior vice president, and had a manner of speaking that reflected the prestige of that title. Powerful, but never pretentious. "Very kind of you to make the trip up here to see us." Olufsen stood to shake hands. "Ah, yes, but of course. I know Redmond's a bit out of the way, but it's got a nice charm, no?" "Absolutely. It's quite a pleasant respite," Olufsen began, deploying just the right amount of untraceable European accent so as to sound worldly but not pretentious, "from the scratchy and clawing of busy cities." "Well put," Lincoln replied. "Why don't I give you a tour of the place and then we can get down to it? How does that sound?" "Lovely," Olufsen said, waving his hand forward. "You lead, I follow." Lincoln took Olufsen through the colorful offices, whimsically decorated with game characters. It felt almost like a tiny Nintendo theme park, except for the noise, or lack thereof. In contrast to the vibrant aesthetics of the place, the employees were relatively quiet. They were all certainly quite friendly and accommodating, but there was a silent seriousness to them, both individually and as a group. After the tour, Lincoln brought Olufsen into a modern white-walled conference room that was filled with images of Donkey Kong, Nintendo's large, lovable, goofy gorilla. The two men sat down at a long, glossy table and briefly discussed this game, which was one of the few games that Olufsen had played himself. "I was quite young back then, but I could tell right away that the game would become a hit," Olufsen explained with a nostalgic smile sewn to his face. "I remember being enveloped with this addictive sense of wonder, which, I must say, is high praise from someone who doesn't much like video games." Lincoln chuckled at the memory. "What's this about not liking games?" "Oh, I don't know," Olufsen said with a shrug. "They're certainly fine. I just think they're a bit of a silly thing. Not so much for me." "That's understandable," Lincoln said. "But then I must ask, why be in this business at all?" "That's a very good and valid question," Olufsen said, pointing playfully at Lincoln. "Though it becomes slightly rhetorical in this audience of two, because we both know the answer." "Because business is business is business?" "In theory, yes. But under the circumstances that brings me here today, I have to ask if that's really the case. I've read through the licensing agreements, reviewed our contracts, and spoken to my guys about some of their adventures with Nintendo. This business, shall we say, is unlike any other that I am familiar with." Lincoln nodded, unsurprised and not at all flustered by these concerns. "I'll grant you that. It's a new industry. One with a promising road ahead." "Absolutely," Lincoln replied. "But 10 years ago, they were saying the very same thing. Video games are a can't-miss." "That, however, didn't turn out to be quite right. A lack of quality control led to chaos, and the whole thing fell apart." "Look, I know what people say about Nintendo, and what publishers, retailers, and everyone else thinks about our strict agreements." Lincoln paused to look Olufsen in the eye, trying to show him that this wasn't just lip service, but sincere understanding from a rational individual. "But there really is a method to the madness. From idea to purchase, it's our job to make sure that a product lives up to Nintendo's standards in order to create a premium entertainment experience. And if we can do that, then consumers, retailers, and everyone else along the food chain gets fed." Olafson nodded sympathetically.
You're obviously an intelligent man. That being the case, I think you can imagine where I might attempt to point out a few imbalances in that logic. Nevertheless, I acknowledge that we're on different sides of the table here, and naturally ought to possess divergent perspectives on issues like these. But, Olafson continued, sharpening his tone, if Nintendo gets to make the rules, then given the company's long-standing relationship with Sony, I would think that some leeway should be in order.
In what sense exactly?
Olafson squinted, choosing his words. In a very general sense, Mr. Lincoln. But I would venture to say that a good start might be for Nintendo to stop treating us like we're nothing but slaves on the plantation.
Lincoln recoiled at the comparison.
That's a bit drastic, wouldn't you say?
My metaphor, in tone perhaps, but in sentiment it feels spot on.
Lincoln shook his head.
I think we're getting off course, and in the spirit of avoiding any further derailment, I'll just say the following. Nintendo values its relationship with Sony, but our licensing agreement for making games is the same with every company, and there are no exceptions.
I see, Olafson said, realizing there was no use to any of this. If this was how Nintendo wanted to play the game, then this was how it would have to be. As he sat there, he had many thoughts about this peculiar new industry.
Many thoughts indeed.
But regardless of the shape, size, and color of these thoughts, he was very much displeased. At this juncture, however, there was no value in showing off his displeasure. Instead, Olafson asked his host to tell him about some of the great promotions that Nintendo had planned for the coming year.
Excellent question, Lincoln replied, and then launched into an upbeat monologue that he must have already given many times. As Lincoln talked about Mario's new pet, some kind of green dinosaur with an off-putting name, Olafson began to zone out and look for new ways to play the hand that he'd been dealt. In the middle of his private brainstorm, his eyes grazed one of the paintings on the wall. It was an image of Donkey Kong readying to throw a barrel that he held over his head. Olafson returned his eyes to Lincoln, but his mind was stuck on Donkey Kong. When they had first entered the room, the image had brought back to Olafson the visceral memory of playing Donkey Kong. But now he was beginning to remember the details of the game. If memory served correctly, Donkey Kong was the story of an arrogant gorilla who enjoyed beating his chest and throwing dangerous obstacles in the way of a courageous little red plumber. Because it was unlike any other game at the time, Donkey Kong was exceptionally difficult to beat. But if a player inserted enough quarters, put in the necessary time, and studied the patterns of the game, it eventually became beatable. And as Lincoln continued to speak about Nintendo's future, Olafson couldn't help but think about what lay ahead for the 800-pound gorilla in the room.
Chapter 16. Rope-a-dope.
Whenever you're at war, you must hit the other guy in the mouth as hard as you can with the first punch,
Ryo explained to Kalinske and Toyota as they plotted Sega's strategy for the upcoming Consumer Electronics Show.
And if you can't hit him hard, you might as well not even fight. That's the attitude in real war, and that ought to be our attitude here as well.
Every year there were two Consumer Electronics Shows, CES, the winter show in Vegas and the summer show in Chicago. In the fragmented, ever-evolving video game industry, which had more in common with the Wild West than, say, with Silicon Valley or Wall Street, the CES provided one of the few opportunities for all the players to come together. The events tended to be a little more than each company pounding its own chest, but they were still a big deal. It was where hype began, reputations were made, and scuffles occasionally took place. This would be Kalinske's first CES, and he wanted to come out with guns blazing, especially in light of Sega's progress, or lack thereof, with Walmart. It had been nearly a month since Sega rented the retail space in Arkansas, and Walmart hadn't even flinched. Instead of relenting, however, Kalinske doubled down. As per the fantasy he had envisioned with Toyota, they sent his executive assistant, Deb Hart, down to Bentonville, with the mission of bringing Segaville to life.
She bought up every available billboard in town, handed out flyers on the streets, and arranged for every seat cushion at the University of Arkansas football team's final home game of the season to bear Sega's logo. Hart had done an incredible job, but all of this was becoming a costly gamble. With no results to show thus far, Kalinske was tempted to compensate by making a splash at CES, but he was compelled by the point that Ryo had made. "If we're being honest with ourselves," Kalinske said, "we just don't have the firepower yet to start going at Nintendo. So, perhaps a little rope-a-dope is in order." Ryo nodded. But Toyota didn't understand the reference, so Kalinske explained how in 1974, Muhammad Ali squared off against George Foreman for a title fight in Zaire that had been dubbed the Rumble in the Jungle. At the time, Foreman was bigger and stronger and packed a more powerful punch than Ali, who realized his only hope was to find a clever solution. Ali's plan was to spend the early rounds getting physically abused, until finally Foreman tired himself out. For most of the fight, Ali verbally taunted Foreman, and then stood in a protective stance, absorbing punch after punch. For 4 rounds, Foreman dominated, but eventually he started to grow tired. When the 5th round began, Ali took advantage of his weakened opponent and demolished him with a series of jabs. 3 rounds later, Ali knocked out Foreman, regained the title belt, and went down in history as a tactical genius.
"Ah," Toyota said. "Like playing the possum."
"Exactly," Kalinske confirmed. "I'm not saying we take a dive, but we want to go at Nintendo right before they launch in America. There's no point in building momentum now only to lose it. We should tease with Sonic, but show no gameplay. Go heavy on Game Gear, and hold back on the rest until this summer." Kalinske looked to Toyota, who nodded, and then to Ryo, whose face always seemed to be made of stone. "Paul?"
"What can I say?"
Ryo asked rhetorically, as a grin chiseled across his face.
"Float like a butterfly and sting like a bee."
A few weeks later, Kalinske checked into his room at the Alexis Park Hotel in Las Vegas, where he and about 20 Sega employees were staying for CES. Following the decision to play things close to the vest, he had arrived in Vegas with low expectations. Even so, it didn't take long for things to spin out of control. Sega began the week by hosting a pre-show sales meeting for retailers where nothing at all seemed to work. Demos didn't play, art designs got mixed up, and the AV system kept breaking down. Not even Nilsson could fix it. Kalinske had known that their strategy for CES would make things challenging, but this felt like amateur hour. He had never experienced anything like this at Mattel, and worst of all, this failure was on his shoulders. If Sega's people weren't properly prepared, then it was because he had failed to prepare them. As president and CEO, he would always get more credit than he deserved, and even more so, always get more of the blame. That's just how it worked. In the face of calamity, he tried to rescue Sega's reputation at the podium. He didn't get the overwhelming reaction he was used to, and on one occasion he was even tempted to whip out the demo of Sonic and talk about how things would be changing, as outlined in his 4-point plan. But as tempting as it was to push the big red panic button, he knew that was not really an option. Following the pre-show miscues, the first day of CES didn't provide much of an improvement. While televisions, stereos, and VCRs were magnificently displayed in the dazzling Las Vegas Convention Center, the video game companies were treated like second-class citizens and relegated to a tent outside. Inside of it, there were about 100 different video game companies who had booths to show off their products. They ranged in size from Tiny to Nintendo, who clearly dominated the festivities with an upscale display of games and peripherals that was so large there was enough room to comfortably fit a stage in the middle. By the end of the show, attendees had taken to calling the Nintendo display the Death Star. Because of the decision to hold back on hyping some of their upcoming games until the summer, Sega's modest booth focused primarily on the Game Gear, a slightly sleeker, Americanized version of the handheld device from Japan. Kalinske, Ryo, and Toyota all liked putting the spotlight on Game Gear, though each for different reasons. Kalinske figured this would make for a good opportunity to temporarily de-emphasize the Genesis, but still managed to further define Sega as edgy, unconventional, and technologically advanced.
Ryo thought very highly of portable game systems and believed deep down that this business would one day overtake home consoles. And Toyota knew that the Japan executives loved showing off hardware more than software, so they would be happy to see so much attention paid to Game Gear. At its core, Game Gear appeared to be an easy sell. It was the color version of Nintendo's Game Boy. Color TV trounced black and white broadcasts, so Game Gear should quickly take its place atop the handheld food chain. While on paper that was true, there were a few hitches to this thinking. Atari's recently released color handheld Lynx had gotten crushed. The battery life on Game Gear was lousy, and their best game for it was an obvious and inferior Tetris ripoff. Beyond Game Gear, Sega's only other gaudy product was the Joe Montana football game that had been rescued by EA. Although they hadn't been able to get it ready in time for the Christmas season, it had actually turned out to be a pretty great game, and would at least give Sega some momentum heading into the new year. That is, as long as consumers didn't realize it was basically just a repackaged version of EA's John Madden football. While Sega employees put the final touches on their booth, Kalinske excused himself to catch an 8 a.m. press conference by Nintendo. Though CES wasn't yet open to the public, the press conference was heavily attended, partly because this speech would serve as the unofficial kickoff to the show, but primarily because anything Nintendo said or did was a huge deal. As a result, Kalinske had to stand in the back of the room, behind journalists, financial analysts, and Nintendo's many fans within the electronics industry. He tried not to admit it to himself, but he missed the whirlwind atmosphere that was so evident in Nintendo's press conference, and which he remembered from his time at Mattel. The thrill of anticipation, the curiosity in the air, and of course, the applause, which came quickly and reached thunderous levels when Peter Main, Nintendo of America's VP of Sales and Marketing, stepped to the podium. Main, a balding man with bewitching brown eyes and round Lenin-like spectacles, nonchalantly quieted the crowd and introduced himself. "There are many great things on the horizon that I'm excited to tell you about," Main said, jumping right in. Like Kalinske, Main was an excellent speaker, but in a very different kind of way. When Kalinske spoke, it was as though he transported audiences into a locker room for a pep talk, and when Main spoke, it was as though he transported audiences into a pub for a quick swig. They were the coach and the bartender. After touting the Super Famicom's success in Japan, Main nonchalantly answered the question on everyone's mind by announcing that Nintendo would release a 16-bit system in America toward the end of the year. He then said that Nintendo had posted another record year in 1990, with 7.2 million Nintendo Entertainment Systems sold and millions of software titles. Sales in the United States topped $3.4 billion. Yet, despite the staggering figures, Main acknowledged that Nintendo had fallen short of analysts' expectations. "We weren't far off the mark," he explained. "What none of us could forecast back in June was the war in the Gulf, the economic volatility resulting from the current recession, and the combined impact of these two external forces." Kalinske took a moment to savor the irony in Main's blaming the conflict in the Middle East for disappointing sales figures, given that journalists had started referring to the Gulf War as the First Nintendo War for its video game-like coverage. Main nimbly navigated through the financial data and then spoke about Nintendo's bold plans to increase their already large pop culture footprint. The company's after-school cartoon had been so gigantically successful, with over 40 million viewers per week, that Nintendo was already in development to make a big-budget Super Mario Brothers movie slated for 1992. After Main finished speaking about Nintendo's unyielding expansion, he segued into answering questions from the audience. One of the first asked if Nintendo was trying to become the next Disney, and if they would soon have their own line of theme parks. Peter Main, who believed that the sky was the limit, didn't dismiss this possibility. "The value of characters like Mario is very strong," he said. "And as we go down the road, you're going to see many applications." Kalinske, who couldn't help imagining his daughters begging him to take them to Nintendo Land, had heard enough. He left the press conference, and after giving a pep talk to the Sega employees, spent the rest of the day wheeling and dealing at various booths across the show. When he had a free moment, he'd watch visitors roam through Sega's home base.
each time someone snickered at their underwhelming roster of games, shrugged or referred to columns as a retarded version of Tetris, Kalinske felt like he'd been punched in the gut. But by the end of the day, he was still standing tall and ready to fight, just like Muhammad Ali. That night, Nintendo relished the role of Top Gun and threw a glitzy party headlined by a performance from singer Kenny Loggins. After a lavish evening of dancing and drinking, Peter Mayne once again took the stage to address an eager audience. This time, though, in the comfort of being among colleagues, his words were as smooth, sleek, and casual as the black silk Nintendo jacket he donned for the occasion. Mayne was joined on stage by Howard Lincoln, who festively wore a spike collar and neon glow sticks around his neck. Celebratory glitter coated the heads of both men. They took turns speaking into the microphone to express gratitude, make jokes, and give away prizes, including a Chevrolet Geo to the winner of Nintendo's Campus Challenge. Afterward, they called up to the stage their boss, Minoru Arakawa, whose fashionably teased hair and oversized fluorescent glasses signified that his typically reserved demeanor was on hold for the evening. As the DJ played the Hollywood Argyle's hit Alley-Oop, Mayne, Lincoln, and Arakawa launched into a song and dance. The roaring applause for these three giddy, gleeful, and uncoordinated middle-aged men was proof of what everyone in the room already believed. Nintendo was invincible. Meanwhile, down the road, Kalinske took his team out for dinner and drinks at an Italian restaurant in a strip mall near their hotel. Sensing a bit of disappointment amongst the troops, he tried his best to play the role of Mr. Brightside. He lifted a cheap glass of Pinot Noir and addressed the 24 Sega employees squeezed around a pair of large, circular tables in the back of the restaurant. "Ladies and gentlemen of Sega," Kalinske said, "I want to personally thank everyone for all your hard work, and I don't just mean for this week, but for all the months of effort that have gone into molding Sega into what we are today." "And what are we?" an employee heckled. "Nintendo's chew toy?" The room filled with good-natured laughter, Kalinske included. "Ha ha! Too ambitious," he said. "Dogs actually acknowledge their chew toys." More laughter ensued. "Hey, I will be the first to admit that this wasn't Sega's finest hour, but let me tell you, our time is coming, and it's right around the corner. 6 months from now, at Summer CES, Nintendo won't know what hit them." A flood of applause swept the tables. "On that note, I wanted to inform you all that I managed to catch part of Peter Mayne's speech today, and he said two things that got me really excited. The first was that Nintendo had another record year of sales in 1990, but had fallen just short of expectations. Can you believe that? They had a record year doing over $3 billion in sales, and that wasn't good enough." Kalinske went on to explain that Nintendo is a victim of the worst enemy of all, high expectations. This was a burden Sega didn't have to carry. They were underdogs through and through, and this was their greatest advantage. "We have nothing to lose," he said, "and that's how we're gonna win." After a chorus of cheers, Nilsson asked about the other thing Mayne had said. "Oh, right. The other thing is that Nintendo is planning a big-budget feature-length movie around the Mario Brothers. And everyone knows that when Hollywood gets involved in anything, things get needlessly complicated," Kalinske said with a smirk. "Anyway, my hand is getting tired of holding this wine glass, which means that I've been going on for way too long. So let me just say congratulations to all of us for surviving the Consumer Electronics Show. Cheers." Glasses of cheap red wine clinked, and a sense of camaraderie permeated the room. As the first course was served, Kalinske regaled his employees with old stories of Mattel in a wistful fairy tale tone. Ryo, having been there, jumped in from time to time, while Toyota wore a smile on his face and occasionally shook his head in disbelief. At the other end of the table, Al Nilsson was sitting between Hugh Bowen and Ed Annunziata. "Did you run that idea by Al?" Bowen on Nilsson's right said to Annunziata. Nah, he won't like it," Annunziata on Nilsson's left replied. Tell him, Bowen said, egging him on. "Nah, man, I'm telling you, he won't like it," Annunziata replied. Nilsson realized right away that this conversation had been rehearsed and that he was being set up.
But the pasta primavera looked good, and it occurred to him that the only way he'd be able to enjoy his meal in peace was to let Tweedledum and Tweedledee finish their skit. All right, Ed, tell me all about whatever it is that I won't like. Okay, so it's like this, Annunziata started, his eyes shining with excitement. Ed Annunziata was a self-taught programmer from New York whose laid-back demeanor and free-flowing vibe made him feel at home when he moved to California. He'd been hired by Sega's head of product development, Ken Balthaser, in 1990 to become the first producer at Sega of America. For the most part, his job entitled Localizing Games from SOJ, meaning that he slightly altered titles like Ghouls and Ghosts and Phantasy Star 2 so they could be understood and enjoyed better by Western audiences. But he hadn't joined Sega just to be SOJ's errand boy and was finally starting to produce his own games. At the moment, he was working on Spider-Man versus the Kingpin and was looking forward to working on original projects as SOA gained more autonomy. I got this idea for a game, but it's unlike anything you've ever seen before. He's not kidding, Bowen echoed. It blew my mind. Forget about Mario and Sonic. Forget about saving the princess and racing through levels to stop the bad guy. This isn't about good or evil. This is about life. Not life as we know it, because we all play that game every day, but life beneath the surface of the ocean. Infinitely long and infinitely deep, where beauty meets danger and the everyday isn't corrupted by the nonsense of words. This is the world's last great unknown, but not for much longer. Because we're going to let people pick up a controller and transform into a dolphin. For the next 45 minutes, Annunziata told the incredible tale of a dolphin who gets caught in a storm and loses contact with the other members of his pod. With nothing but the power of a sonar, he has only one chance of reconnecting with his beloved pod, by going on a quest across the ocean. He'll need to trek to the Arctic and find a revered whale, swim into a deep cavern, and meet the oldest creature on Earth, and eventually find his way to the lost city of Atlantis. When he finished, Nilsson was at a rare loss for words. Wow. I told you, Bowen said. Just, wow, Nilsson said again. How did you come up with that? An artist never reveals his secrets, Annunziata said before chugging the rest of his glass of wine. But I'm getting nice and drunk, so all such rules go out the window. It's just been like growing in my mind for months. It started when I read this great book called The Founding, which was from the POV of a humpback whale. Then I got into reading all this stuff from John Lilly about taking LSD and going into a sensory deprivation tank. The guy spent his entire life trying to communicate with dolphins. And then one day I just asked myself, how can I translate all that into a side-scrolling game? Let's do it, Nilsson said, prompting Bowen and Annunziata to nearly collapse from shock. Nilsson knew this was exactly the kind of risk that Kalinske had been talking about, an opportunity that would redefine Sega. Though nothing like this had ever been done before, Nilsson didn't even have a doubt. He reasoned that if Annunziata could pull off even half of what he described, Sega would still have an incredible game, something special that could spawn a whole new genre while helping to differentiate Sega from the companies flooding the market with Me Too games. And as the evening wore on, any remaining seeds of doubt from the Consumer Electronics Show were washed away by a mighty river of wine. Kalinske watched with pride as his employees spent the long evening sharing stories that had been locked away in the attics of memory, hopes and dreams from the past, and hopes and dreams for the future. For the rest of the week, Sega's team of dreamers would endure every punch that the industry had to throw. But 6 months later, at the Summer Consumer Electronics Show in Chicago, it would be a completely different type of fight. Chapter 17. Showdown. It really was quite lovely, this Super Nintendo device. And durable, too, thought Olaf Olafsson, as his fingers danced atop the machine's pale gray exterior. Of the hundreds of people who had shown up for the great unveiling of the Super Nintendo at the 1991 Summer CES at Chicago's McCormick Place, it was safe to say that Olafsson was the only one pedantically focused on aesthetics.
The rest were there to see the games, the graphics, and the next 5 years of their lives begin to take shape. That's why, by 8 a.m, hundreds had already arrived, and thousands more were on their way. The wait was finally over. Having satisfied his curiosity, Olufsen moved through Nintendo's massive booth. No, booth wasn't the proper word. Their display was more like a towering black fortress that had erupted out of the gray carpeted floor, at least 5 times the size and 2x the height of any other video game company's booth. The height not only enhanced Nintendo's prominence, but also blocked out the sharp halogen lighting above. As a result, the shade, the black color scheme, and the dark floor all served to masterfully highlight the bright, bouncing colors of their video games. It struck Olufsen as both odd and impressive that Nintendo had so ably managed to balance the dark with the light. Not just today, but in general. To suit their needs, Nintendo expertly toggled between coming across as a fun-loving toy company and presenting themselves as a gravely serious tech firm. While it was hardly unusual for an organization to wear two faces, it was rare for one to go so long without having to choose one path or another. But then again, there was no competitor out there who could force Nintendo's hand. Olufsen checked his watch and realized it was time to go. Nintendo's press conference would begin shortly, and it was important that he be there. He adjusted his tie and moved against a strong current of smiling faces funneling in. Normally, he was immune to such infectious excitement, but the grin on his face revealed that today was a special occasion. Less than 24 hours earlier, Olufsen had given a press conference of his own, in which he announced that Sony would be getting into the hardware business. The journalists were immediately intrigued by the prospect of Sony competing against Nintendo, two giant Japanese firms going head-to-head. He could already imagine the overly dramatic articles that would be published, filled with comparisons to battles between Godzilla and Mothra. But it was actually the opposite. Sony was going into business with Nintendo. In late 1992, Sony would be releasing the Nintendo PlayStation, which would be a peripheral device that attached to the Super Nintendo and play games on CD. At this time, it was generally understood by both experts and laypeople that CDs would soon become the standard delivery mechanism for all entertainment, music, movies, and video games. It just made too much sense. A CD could hold 10 times as much information as a 16-bit game cartridge at 1/10 of the price. Perhaps there was a whimsical charm to game cartridges, but this was a matter of technological Darwinism, and Sony was thrilled to be evolving with Nintendo. The alliance was fantastic in so many ways. Working with Nintendo gave Sony clout in the video game space. The creative relationship would ensure that the PlayStation had top-level games, which was especially key because Sony's software publisher, ImageSoft, was still struggling on that front. And last, but certainly not least, this could be a financial windfall. Not only would Sony make money on each PlayStation sold, but just like Nintendo and Sega, they would get to play the role of toll collector and collect fees from software companies who wanted to create games for their CD-shaped roads. Olufsen's announcement yesterday had created a stir, but not nearly the whirlwind that he anticipated after Nintendo did the same at their press conference. After all, a proclamation from the king carried more weight than one from the noble prince. And as Olufsen took a seat in the front row of the conference room at McCormick Place, he eagerly awaited being handed the keys to the kingdom. As per usual, Nintendo's press conference was packed. This one, however, carried an extra flair of excitement and felt like the beginning of a grand new era. Olufsen was unsure who the speaker would be. Typically, that honor would go to the president, in this case Minoru Arakawa, but he didn't enjoy speaking in public. Instead, Nintendo's official proclamations were made by either Peter Main or Howard Lincoln. Olufsen was curious how they decided who would speak at which occasion, and he made a mental note to explore this in future meetings. At 9 a.m., Lincoln stepped to the podium. He welcomed the audience, invited them to check out Nintendo's booth after the speech, and then spoke at length about the Super NES, which would hit stores on August 23, 1991. All systems would come with the groundbreaking new Super Mario World game, while four others would immediately be available for purchase. F-Zero, Pilot Wings, Gradius 3, and SimCity. Their library would quickly grow, with 18 games available by Christmas. Lincoln confirmed that, as with the Super Famicom, there would be no backward compatibility, and the 16-bit Super NES couldn't play 8-bit NES games. Sensing a degree of dissatisfaction, he quickly assured everyone that Nintendo was still very much committed to supporting the